of y'all in the Christ.
A little Christ in the heart, you know, see it. The Almighty, you know, see it. Next week, same place, same time, you know, see it.
The following is a previously broadcast program.
KUT 90.3 FM.
Hello, listeners. This is a rebroadcast of No One's Legal Radio on Off the Hour from December 2020. It's a rebroadcast, but still very relevant, as we feature three interviews about U.S. politics in the aftermath of the Trump defeat, but the persistence of far-right Trumpism. We'll be back with new shows on the first Thursday of every month from 5 to 6 p.m.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news have brought to you live.
It's December 3rd, 2020, and you're listening to a pandemic red zone edition of No One's Legal Radio, which is part of No Borders Media and the CKUT Communities Collective's Off the Hour at 90.3 FM in Montreal, www.ckut.ca on the web. On today's show, we continue to get perspective and an analysis on American politics in the context of the end of the Trump administration, but not the end of Trumpism, and the beginning of the neoliberal Biden administration. We speak today with three commentators of American politics. Later on the show, we'll hear from Africanist and Black Studies scholar Yannick Giovanni Marshall, author of the article, After This Election, We Should Not Come Together. Also later on the show, we get analysis and perspective from Shane Burley of Portland, Oregon. He's the author of Fascism Today, What It Is and How to End It. But first up, an interview with one of the co-editors of It's Going Down, an essential anarchist anti-capitalist news source. IGD has provided important coverage of U.S.-based resistance to colonialism, capitalism, and fascism, and was banned by Facebook for their uncompromising coverage. All three interviews today are short excerpts from longer feature interviews that No Borders Media will be featuring online. No One's Legal Radio is part of No Borders Media and the CKUT Communities Collective's Off the Hour. Follow No Borders Media on Facebook, SoundCloud, Twitter, or Instagram for the podcast version of the show and other podcasts in support of the struggles of oppressed peoples and in opposition to capitalism and colonialism. Let's go to our first interview with It's Going Down right now. I'm speaking with one of the editors of It's Going Down, one of the essential sites of alternative news vis-a-vis resistance in the U.S., autonomous, anarchist, anti-capitalist resistance. Hey, welcome back to No Borders Media.
Thanks. As we were saying before we started recording, I guess we talked like 4 years ago, which seems like it just kind of flew by.
It seems that way, but obviously it didn't. And, you know, when we were talking roughly 4 years ago, we were assessing the possibilities of resistance and the demoralization that people felt, even though we're not really into electoral shit, the idea that the alt-right, the far-right, you know, this kind of dog whistle and not so dog whistle racist politics had wind in its sails was demoralizing. But at the same time, there was a lot of inspiring stuff, such as, you know, spontaneous demos on the streets. And when the travel ban was announced, you know, demonstrations at airports and stuff. So just as an overall, you know, sort of generic question, you know, how are you feeling about, you know, that resistance back then 4 years ago and how it's evolved up until now? I mean, we definitely can speak about a rebellion that's happening even to this day since George Floyd's killing. But talk about how you assess those 4 years, 4 years plus of resistance in the U.S. to Trump and the far right.
Well, I think there's a lot that could be said, and I think that probably we'll have to take some time to really gather our thoughts in a lot of ways as to what's going on and kind of our analysis in terms of what we see the social movements on the ground doing. But I think the most important dynamic is that there's been more or less sort of a split between the Democratic aligned nonprofits and kind of activist groups and evolving autonomous social movements on the ground. And now I would group within that like Native Struggles, Water Protectors, the Black Liberation Struggle, autonomous formations inside prisons, what prisoners are doing, this kind of growing autonomous tenant movement that's evolving both in so-called Canada and the U.S. You know, obviously you have currents like, you know, anarchists or autonomous anti-capitalists, which are, you know, organizing in different capacities. You have different environmental currents, you have different labor currents, you have kind of all of these things happening, and they're all kind of like feeding off of each other and working on different things. Obviously, in the aftermath of the pandemic, we saw this huge growth of mutual aid networks and groups form across not only the U.S. and Canada, but also across the world. And I mean, there's a lot of things to be said about these, both positive and critical, and kind of like showing the both the limits and possibilities of these models. But I think overall, people are excited about having this ability to interact with their neighbors in a really real down-to-earth way. It's been really exciting to see the growth of capacity, which is something that a lot of people talk about, the growth of capacity of autonomous movements to organize and engage with people. You know, obviously there's a lot to be said about, you know, the rebellion that happened. I think, you know, just as interesting and exciting is the growth of these mutual aid networks, and also things like in the U.S. we have this growing autonomous tenant union network that's encompassing more and more cities, that's, you know, made up of groups that are talking and organizing with thousands of people around the issue of evictions and rising rent and gentrification. So I think all of these things are really exciting. There's a lot of stuff going on. I don't really see the contradictions within the current system leading to like a decrease in movements at all. We could talk, I'm sure we'll talk about what's happening with the far right. There's been a lot of things that have changed since 2016 and 2017. But as we speak right now, there's two big mobilizations that are being called on different coasts in the United States. And the far right is essentially attempting to rebrand itself kind of in a seemingly what's soon to be a post-Trump world. And I don't think that it's going to go away anytime soon. In fact, I think with different kind of factors, we're seeing almost the solidification of kind of a neo-fascist current, which could give rise to something akin to like Golden Dawn in the United States very soon.
After a few days after the election, I was able to speak with Arun Gupta, who spent a bunch of time in Portland, and he talked about how Trumpism, if that's maybe a substitute for talking about the far right, is as strong as ever, even though he lost the election. I listened to a really awesome episode of This Is America that you did just, I'm not sure how long ago, but about assessing the Millions MAGA march that took place in D.C. And, you know, the two pitfalls are overstating and understating the threat of this far right. And, you know, your commentator there that you have on a lot did a really good job on breaking down that, look, they're a threat, but let's not overstate the possibility of civil war and what have you. You mentioned these two demos that are happening and the fact that the far right is reconsolidating itself in different ways and will continue to do so. I think you'd agree with me that, you know, over these 4 years, we've seen a lot of inspiring resistance, but unfortunately, the far right hasn't fizzled out. If anything, it's as strong as ever. So assess that a bit for us. Where things are at, and if you can, you know, let people know about what is happening in terms of these mobilizations on either coast.
Sure. So what I would say is that what happened between, 2016 and the start of the Trump period was that a coalition was built between autonomous Trump supporters, the alt-right, which is, you know, white nationalists who want an all-white ethno-state and more or less are fascist-aligned, neo-Nazis, also militias, groups like the Proud Boys, and, you know, groups like the Oath Keepers, Three Percenters, all that stuff, kind of like formed like an ad hoc, more or less street coalition that began to hold free speech rallies. And sort of out of this, the alt-right kind of was feeling itself and decided to organize a rally on its own to try to kind of like gain a leadership role within this kind of nascent post-Trump movement. And that, of course, was Charlottesville, and that, of course, went horribly. And the aftermath of that was that a lot of people got involved in anti-fascist street mobilization. So basically a lot of people that would consider themselves on the left or even like liberals and progressives basically made the decision that the anti-fascist argument essentially was correct, was that people needed to go into the streets in mass numbers and confront the alt-right and the far right and basically push them off the streets. And that's kind of like what we saw across the country. And obviously in different cities, I mean, realistically, when you kind of like look at Portland, you look at kind of like the genealogy of like, you know, each rally, like sometimes the far right side would be have more people. Most times they'd be outnumbered. Sometimes they'd be driven out of the city. Sometimes it would end in a brawl. You know, sometimes the far right would send people to the hospital. Other times there'd just be a standoff that went nowhere. I mean, a lot of different things happened, like especially in Portland. There's, I mean, you know, books could be written on the subject, and I'm sure that they are. Much the same like in the Bay Area. But by and large, by like 2018, the alt-right section of the movement had been basically pushed off the streets. Like Richard Spencer and a lot of those people had just been, they had been branded so hard in the eyes of so many people as, you know, the enemy, that they, anytime that they attempted to do anything, you know, hundreds of people would show up and basically shut them down. But at the same time, you know, starting around basically after the midterms in the United States, I would say that there was a realization that, you know, Trump could very well be pushed out of office. And that there was a lot of people in the United States that didn't like him, and that there was more or less kind of a reconstitution of a pro-Trump far-right street current, and that at the head of that was the Proud Boys. And the Proud Boys really benefited from the fact that they, at least on, you know, the way they present themselves, is a multiracial organization. You know, we don't care if we have gay members. You know, we're not neo-Nazis, were just Western chauvinists. I mean, you know, we could spend a whole hour talking about how their entire project is racially based. I mean, they're founded by Gavin McGinnis, who wrote for white nationalist publications like American Renaissance. And, you know, McGinnis argued that whites and blacks should not live together. I mean, their basically founding document, kind of the book that they look up to as sort of their capital, is Pat Buchanan's Death of the West. And Pat Buchanan is a famous paleoconservative bordering on white nationalist, worked very closely with white nationalists like Sam Francis. But I mean, that's kind of like where their politics are based. They really want to, as McGinnis would say, shut the borders down and force people to acclimate to, quote, white culture. They want to basically turn back the clock to a pre-civil rights, you know, pre-1960s America. So, I mean, that's their goal. So, I mean, the fact that they are an organization that includes some people of color, including leadership positions, really is besides the point. They're essentially a white supremacy group that's open to people that aren't white. And I think that, you know, as other people have argued, I mean, I think this is kind of the way that fascism in the future will be sort of organized. And even like with the Republican Party seeking out the votes of like conservative Cubans in Florida and stuff like that. I mean, as we've seen in the past, whiteness is something that has opened itself to other groups that before have not been seen as white. Like, so for instance, the Irish or Italians, in order to, you know, create a bulwark against, you know, other sections of society, or to, you know, combat class struggle or multiracial anti-capitalist action. So the Proud Boys are kind of at the forefront of this new street formations of far-right groups. And I would also include in within that like groups like the Three Percenters and the Oath Keepers, the militias, and also just kind of like the MAGA crowd itself. And like thrown into the mix also has been this dramatic increase, which has just exploded in the aftermath of the pandemic, of people that support things like QAnon or COVID trutherism, or kind of like wacky conspiracy theories that are somehow related to, you know, COVID-19 or the election, or, you know, somehow just kind of like grow out of like the far right media space. So, I mean, this new coalition has really grown in the aftermath of all of these kind of like reopen protests. And then now you've had the Stop the Steal rallies. You've also had like a wave of Trump election rallies. So these people are kind of like used to like mobilizing on the streets. And they look at groups like the Proud Boys as sort of like their version of the Black Bloc. And they're like held up as the defenders and, you know, fighters of those street mobilizations. So I think that's scary in a lot of ways because they've managed to solidify a movement that in one instance has its foot in politics, you know, has ways of funding itself from various elites, and also has this very violent street component movement that they're very comfortable with. And I don't see that changing anytime soon. And I think the other variable is that with Biden winning the 2020 election, a lot of liberals and progressives, I feel like, sort of feel like, hey, we've got this in the bag. Like, why do we need to go out and like protest these people? Like, they're just a bunch of wackos screaming about QAnon at the Capitol. Like, who cares? And I mean, there is some truth in that. And I think that, you know, like each engagement needs to be kind of analyzed and thought about in different ways. But as we've seen across the United States in the past couple of weeks, although the rallies in support of Trump have gotten smaller and in some cases have like almost kind of pivoted away from being about Trump to now being about opposing lockdown measures around COVID, these coalitions are still really kind of solidifying. And like, so for instance, in Sacramento, they've held rallies the past like 5 weeks at the Capitol, and they've always ended at the end with people marching to this park where for years Food Not Bombs has like served, and like where people have kind of used it as a kickoff point for the different protests that were happening over the rebellion. And basically the like potentially like upwards of like a couple hundred people with Proud Boys at the head are just marching around the city looking for quote Antifa to attack and beat up. So I mean, you know, that's a very scary situation, and obviously something that like, you know, people don't want to see right now. As we speak, there's a demonstration that's called for this Saturday to oppose that. Also in D.C. on the 12th, there's another massive call to oppose the Proud Boys, who say they're coming back to D.C. This would be the time after. Sorry, this would be like the coming back after the Millions for MAGA march in which several anti-fascists were stabbed. So I think this will be kind of like showing in terms of, you know, how much strength they do have behind them. I mean, definitely it's a different scene than it was in you know, Unite the Right. Some of the same players are still there. There's still a white nationalist section within it, which is the Groypers, which is led by Nick Fuentes.
Yeah.
But their whole thing is building, you know, kind of a white nationalist current within the MAGA movement or the pro-Trump movement. So, I mean, it's all still kind of like based around, excuse me, Trump remaining the sort of like figurehead. And I think that, I mean, our analysis is that what we'll see is that, you know, basically Trump will lose and that the leader of the RNC will be deposed, and that sort of the moderates within the RNC will kind of rise, and we'll see kind of like a neocon, you know, rise 2.0. And Trump will basically go off and do his own thing, maybe start like his own InfoWars or like, you know, take over One American News or something like that. And that's going to really split the Republican Party. But at the same time, you know, we'll see like a sizable fascist bloc coalesce around Trump and whoever kind of like is able to capture that mantle. And there's also a lot of other people, like, so for instance, like Ann Coulter, who's been sort of like on the fringes between white nationalists and conservative politics for decades and like has been like a Trump advisor. I mean, she's come out totally against Trump, just thinks he's totally inept, like a loser, can't do anything, which, I mean, there's a lot of truth in that. But I mean, her argument is that we want Trumpism without Trump. And like, also that's something that like Tucker Carlson has been kind of getting at, is that we want to basically take over this Trump apparatus, but we want to do it without Trump. And I think in some ways that will happen, but at the same time, I mean, there's so much of a cult of personality built around him. It's almost hard to see it continuing without him or one of his kids, perhaps. But I mean, there's for sure that I mean, the power of Trump and just the cult that he's built, which includes hardcore sections of far right street formations, is not going away anytime soon. And I think that it's that means that it's more incumbent on the social movements, especially at a time when there's kind of not going to be this nascent, oh, Trump is in power, it sucks, like the people protesting are more or less the good people, even if we have some qualms about that. That whole kind of veneer is going to go away now that Biden's in office. So it's people are going to have to work even harder to mobilize and organize people. So it's going to be really interesting to see what the street movements do in the coming terrain. But, you know, people are still very energized. But I think that people are in for a lot of work ahead of them for sure.
This is No One's Legal Radio, which is part of No Borders Media and the CKUT Communities Collective's Off the Hour at 90.3 FM in Montreal, www.ckut.ca on the web. On today's show, we get perspective and analysis on U.S. politics in the context of the end of the Trump administration, but not the end of Trumpism, and the beginning of the neoliberal Biden administration. We just heard an interview with an editor of It's Going Down. Up next, Shane Burley from Portland, Oregon. He's the author of Fascism Today, What It Is and How to End It. I'm speaking with Shane Burley. Shane is based in Portland, Oregon, where he's a writer and activist. He's the author of Fascism Today, What It Is and How to End It by AK Press, and the upcoming book, Why We Fight, Essays on Fascism, Resistance, and Surviving the Apocalypse. Shane, welcome to No Borders Media.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Shane, we'll definitely get into your current book, Fascism Today, What It Is and How to End It, and your upcoming book as well. But I do want to ask you about current events and maybe not so current events, but, you know, basically the uprising in Portland, which became an epicenter of people's attention, an epicenter of protest in support of Black Lives Matter and in opposition to police brutality, in opposition to fascism. You, as a resident of Portland and as an anti-fascist, were definitely following what was going on. Give our listeners, especially listeners, you know, not based in the Pacific Northwest and maybe not even based in the U.S., an understanding of the importance of this sustained protests that were happening nightly in Portland, Oregon, over a period of several months. What was the importance of that? What were the dynamics involved with that? I know it's a large question, but take what part of it you think it's important to convey to our listeners.
Yeah, so obviously all around the country and around the world, there was a global uprising in the wake of the killing of George Floyd, basically an uprising against systemic police violence and white supremacy. And there was, you know, aggressive protests all around the country, obviously in Minneapolis, where they burned down police stations, and in other places where really mass action was taken in a more militant fashion. And that was true in Portland. May 29th was the first large day of protest. There was a vigil that marched, took thousands of people into the downtown area towards the Justice Center, sort of the center of federal law enforcement, where protesters broke in and set it on fire, and then looted, which was sort of a luxury mall a few blocks away, looted places like Louis Vuitton and the Apple Store, which is essentially in line with what happened around the country. It was actually, you know, sort of Portland matching up with the tone that had been set everywhere else. That's not uncommon for Portland necessarily. I mean, that level of it maybe is a bit of a flashpoint, but generally what we call the I-5 corridor, basically the Pacific Northwest in the U.S., Seattle, Oregon, other places, tend to have a more aggressive tone of protests. And there's a long history of direct action from the environmental movement, anti-fascist movement, labor movement, and other things. So it's not totally uncommon. And protests sustained in Portland for several weeks, just like they had around the country. Portland has, again, that large protest infrastructure. There's lots of organizing that happens. There's a large kind of radical base to a lot of it. So it was able to sustain itself over time. And in that time, the Portland police, which is typical in a fashion that is typical for the Portland police, used incredibly aggressive tactics, crowd control tactics, using chemical weapons, CS gas, you know, heavy use of impact munitions, which were really dangerous. and really clamped down really, really hard on protests. It was almost as though they wanted to make the point for protesters themselves that they were engaging in police violence. And they did it in a very spectacular fashion, one that was captured nightly at these protests as people, you know, would, you know, live stream on Twitter or journalists would post that kind of thing. And they were attacking press in particular and street medics who were there providing mutual aid support, like medical support for people injured from the cops. So they were attacking those people as well, which was, again, something that helped brought a lot of more outrage. That helped get people back out to help to sustain it. But then also, because of that sustained protest, Trump ordered in federal officers. Basically, he used an executive order in a very strange way to, quote-unquote, protect federal monuments, saying the building was a monument, sent federal officers, it was sort of a confederation of things like Border Patrol and other agencies, dressed in stuff akin to military fatigues, and they basically laid siege on that area of the city. And in response to that, the protests only ballooned. You know, they had gotten down to a few hundred. They went back up to several thousand. And this became a standoff with these federal officers. The federal officers were using such blanket heavy munitions that it felt like a war zone, very accurately like a war zone. You know, so people obviously see videos of officers storming in and spraying tear gas. But I don't think what people are realizing is we're talking about dozens of canisters of military grade CS gas put out in seconds, basically clearing out entire city blocks, you know, that are becoming uninhabitable, people collapsing with seizures, you know, people going into asthma attacks, and then people being beaten very severely with batons and things like that. They were also running these sort of snatch and grab operations, basically just snatching protesters off the street, taking them to jail, and then basically letting them out when they demand attorneys. So there's a lot of these very kind of strange things happening that helped to inspire a lot more people to come back out. You saw these things called like the Wall of Moms, which essentially was older folks, moms and dads that were lining up and blocking police from protesters, dads bringing out things like leaf blowers to blow back the CS gas that would be everywhere. And that just kept things going more and more and more. And after the federal officers eventually left, the Portland police came back with the Oregon State Police and other folks, and eventually federal deputization of local officers. And they used even more aggressive force in some cases, very kind of hands-on, heavy baton, really aggressive kind of mean-spirited attacks on protesters. So this lasted for months and months and months in this kind of constant melee of police attacks, with really the only thing that kind of settled it temporarily was the mass forest fires that hit all over Oregon and kind of blanketed the area with smoke. So these protests continued basically until the election with a few kind of exceptions. Things have quieted down a little bit, but this was certainly the largest kind of political uprising, radical uprising I've ever seen in the city, the largest and most sustained protest in the city's history, which is one that has decades and decades of militant action. So it is one that really stands out, confronting was a really kind of exceptional police force. The first real police union, one that has really fought to protect officers from accountability, and one that has really hinged its success on its ability to use just brutal, brutal force to put down any opposition.
At some point during this uprising, the Trump administration designated Portland as an anarchist jurisdiction, if that's correct. So my congratulations for that designation. But
they're not wrong, you know.
Yeah, but can you maybe put in perspective the exploitation of what was happening in Portland by broader political forces, whether it be mainstream Democrats that maybe wanted to distance from people demanding defunding the police or engaging in sustained street protests. Or whether it's the right and far right that was portraying Portland as lawless and a so-called anarchist jurisdiction.
Yeah, I mean, this comes from all angles. So obviously the far right has a benefit in trying to paint any opposition as somehow, dangerous and I don't know, murderous or something so insidious that it's going to undermine your everyday life or something. Those protests, which were often marked by things like property destruction and like graffiti and things like that, were posed as violent protests as opposed to the quote-unquote pure nonviolent protests. But the reality was is that the violence was almost entirely one-sided. I mean, we did statistical analysis on this. We looked at the data on it. We looked at actual the records and studies that have been done on this. The violence is almost all either on the police side or far-right vigilantes attacking protesters. Protesters themselves, for the generally, their violence, quote-unquote, is setting trash fires and breaking windows. And so this idea that they were engaging in violence against the city was one that basically victimized or basically tried to villainize the victims of police violence. That's the reality of it. And so it allowed people to not take the protesters seriously, for one, to not listen to their actual demands, to not listen to the criticism. It allowed them to use even more excessive force on protesters, to use unremitting violence and overcharging on them. It allowed the city to then be the target of villainy and to threaten pulling federal funds and all the kinds of things that people generally need in a city to keep functioning. It allowed Republicans to do what they want to do, which is to further victimize poor people and marginalized communities. All of those things serve those kind of interests. They do not serve actual community safety or anything like that. Democrats, on the other hand, don't have much of a better track record on this and essentially wanted to divide the protesters into ones that engage in kind of purely symbolic protests that are done within kind of accepted parameters. And there was some kind of like, you know, local politicians that would come out and do kind of a little bit of like a press event and participate in some ways, or would kind of support the protests in as much as they were against the Trump administration or they were very broad at messaging. But once it passed a certain threshold, they obviously wanted to pull out their support and things like that. They weren't willing to, you know, entertain things like an abolitionist politics or really profoundly defunding the police or severely changing the police in any fundamental way. Anything that actually from the protesters that threatened to actually destabilize power in any meaningful way was not something that we're going to support. Far-right media had a field day with this. I mean, nothing is scarier than people dressed in black fighting the police, particularly when you can call them Antifa, even though that label doesn't really correctly apply in this case. This was the main fodder for right-wing media from Fox News to Andy Ngo for months and months and months. This idea that there was some dangerous ideological cadre that was taking over the city, that was engaging in terrorist acts, that was victimizing people, that were singling out officers or whatever, usually taking kind of fragmented videos or mistaking the events and just trying to single out individuals. And that was a really heavy part of Trump's reelection campaign, basically a sort of law and order message, but it was also one that basically signaled to everyone that they needed to consider themselves occupied by an alien leftist force, outside agitators coming in and damaging the city. And all that does is allows them to refuse to listen to the fact that largely marginalized communities were leading these protests and they're demanding changes to things that personally affect them, and that there was mass participation in changing the police at a really fundamental level. All of these attempts are ways of not taking that seriously, not addressing the problems, and putting the attention back on the people that are suggesting the issues rather than the people causing them.
Relative to the rest of the U.S., Portland is, to use these flawed terms, but I guess they're still useful enough. Portland is relatively liberal compared to the rest of the U.S. And the Pacific Northwest, I mean, obviously there are differences within the Pacific Northwest, but, you know, cities like Seattle and Portland are considered relatively liberal. Yet Portland became this epicenter of protest, and also the Pacific Northwest, whether in Seattle or Bellingham or elsewhere, have, I guess, disproportionately a higher level of organized street level far-right presence. So can you just talk about those dynamics? A very liberal city in terms of some of those basic categories, and Portland being this epicenter of protests and also being a place where the far-right, whether it be Proud Boys, whether it be other far-right groups, want to sort of show a street presence. What accounts for all of that dynamic?
I mean, there's a lot of things that account to it. It's foundational to Oregon's history. It was founded as essentially a white homeland, one that was going to, you know, keep out communities of color. It was one that hyper-exploited Black workers and Chinese workers before them and other immigrant communities over the years. It was one of the primary centers of the Klan in the 20s. It was the center of the Silver Shirts and the German-American Boone in the 30s. It was a center of militia organizing in the 1970s and forward, white supremacist neo-Nazi skinhead gangs in the 80s, and the growth of the Patriot movement of Keepers 3%ers, and now things like the Proud Boys. There's a really, really heavy contingent here. Part of it comes from like the weird kind of working class communities that sometimes foster both left-wing and right-wing radicalism around, you know, issues of austerity and economic issues and kind of like working class angst. There's the kind of urban-rural divide that happens. It's basically deep blue areas surrounded by red rural areas throughout the state. Same is true in places like Washington. Some of that comes from there. And I think it's also because Portland is has been a vanguard in some organizing spaces, particularly on queer issues, environmental issues, and that has created, you know, clashes with people who find that, I don't know, threatening to their mores. And so sometimes when there is a pressure from radical movements, there's a certain amount of backlash. Portland is also overwhelmingly white. And there's a lot that goes along with that. So Portland is a liberal city, and I think it's important to call it a liberal city because it's really not like a left-wing political place. Portland, like San Francisco or like Seattle, has a heavy influx of tech, has rising property values and heavy amounts of gentrification. It has often thrown marginalized communities, communities of color, obviously poor communities under the bus in their attempt to kind of build themselves up as a liberal branded Mecca. And that has created vast amounts of inequality in the city. And historically, the Portland police have been the security guards of that inequality and have aggressively policed communities of color and have allowed or even worked with white nationalist groups to also attack those communities of color. So if you're going to ask Black Portlanders or other communities of color in the city, I can tell you that there is a huge amount of hate crimes that happens here, that there's a lot of racist targeting, that there's a racist politics that underskirts Portland that may not be reflected in other cities. So Portland really stands out in a lot of those ways. That overwhelmingly white nature has a really strong effect no matter what politics it attempts to subscribe to or brand itself with. That doesn't extend as far as the actual reality of white supremacy that underskirts the state of the city.
This is No One Is Legal Radio, which is part of No Borders Media and the CKUT Communities Collective's Off the Hour at 90.3 FM in Montreal, www.ckut.ca on the web. On today's show, we get perspective and analysis on U.S. politics in the context of the end of the Trump administration, but not the end of Trumpism, and the beginning of the neoliberal Biden administration. We just heard an interview with Shane Burley from Portland, Oregon, author of Fascism Today, What It Is and How to End It. Up next, Africanist and Black Studies scholar Yannick Giovanni Marshall, author of the post-election article, After This Election, We Should Not Come Together. I'm speaking with Yannick Giovanni Marshall. Yannick is an assistant professor of Africana studies, someone who writes quite extensively on the theme of Black studies, on Pan-Africanism. You'll be hearing in the background some waves, and that's because Yannick is speaking to us near the Indian Ocean. Yannick, welcome to No Borders Media.
Thank you very much.
Yannick, I want to start on this show. We've been talking a lot about the post-election environment, speaking to a lot of different commentators, all coming from an anti-capitalist left position, but with various nuances. You wrote a piece on Al Jazeera, where you often write. The title of the piece was After the Election, We Should Not Come Together. Black people would be better spending their energy on international solidarity rather than on reconciliation with Trump supporters. A major theme that we're getting from centrist voices and even liberal voices post-election is that, Biden will be a calming influence. There won't be drama. And part of not having drama is to avoid ideological tensions. I guess that's one way of putting it. So let our listeners know about why you feel that we should not be coming together and why we should be putting the focus on who's the oppressor and who's the oppressed.
I think that it's unwise to rejoin an alliance with a system, with an institution, with a set of political actors that have throughout history not proven to give us space for an adequate liberation, an adequate life safe from a racist violence. If there was 1 hour, 1 month, or 1 year in the history of white conservatism in the colony that was amenable to Black survival, then maybe there could be an argument from our lives there. But I don't see it as, like, there's nothing in history that points to unity with far-right conservatism anywhere to be useful. But I do think that the liberal argument continues, not based on history, but based on patriotism and a sense of hope that is just blind faith in a system that has proven to be anti-Black, to continuously spew this idea that we can be, one day things will change and they will be taken away from their ignorance and start believing in all unity, we're all Americans. And because, first of all, I wouldn't have faith in just for what happened yesterday or the day before to think that there would be any useful unity in the future. But considering the past 400 years, it doesn't seem to be in any reason to actually think that, okay, this time with Biden, freedom is on the horizon. I do think that there should be a removal from this hope in settler colonialism and a thinking of other forms of subaltern alliances, subaltern workers, other, especially in this age where it's easy to be able to speak to somebody across the world, to build imagined communities elsewhere, that those things should be sought out, those things should be built, rather than continuously finding yourself for some reason confined to the local colony. There is no reason to believe that a colony has the redemptive power that it promises. And just by the sense of what the white supremacist colony is, but that plus history should lead any reasonable observer to think that the colony does not allow space for Black freedom.
One argument used by liberals, and I'm going to give the, you know, the best possible interpretation of this argument, and this is specific to the United States, is that, well, first of all, the United States has a procedural democracy that allows for transfers of power. And the argument goes, it's sort of the other side of the coin of the fear of white nationalists, which is the demographic threat that at some point in the next 20 to 40 years, the United States is going to be, whites in the United States will be a minority vis-a-vis Blacks and Latinos and other minorities. So this argument, and I would maybe, you know, suggest somebody like Stacey Abrams, the Democratic gubernatorial candidate in Georgia, but somebody who's been identified with Black voter turnout efforts. And there's a big focus on Georgia right now because of the Senate seats there and the fact that Georgia went blue instead of red this time around. The argument is that the demographics right now supports a progressive majority, not a revolutionary or anti-colonial majority, but a progressive majority. That is, Latino voters that vote, you know, two-thirds towards the Democrats, Black voters, and progressive urban whites are essentially going to be a electoral majority if they can come out enough, like they did this time, and the trends bear that out. One argument that's used, for example, is that in the last eight elections, while the Republicans have won several of them, they've only had a majority once out of eight elections in the electoral vote. So what's your response to that argument? Which, I mean, some of the things that go along with that argument is that there should be a focus on voter turnout, specifically turnout of people that white supremacists and white conservatives try to suppress. That is essentially Black voters. That electoral argument in 2020 and going forward is a lot different than it would have been in 1960 or 1980 even, there is hope for progressive reforms. And again, as revolutionaries or as people who are committed to a strong internationalist anti-colonial politic, that doesn't necessarily excite us, but that is an argument we have to reckon with. What's your response to that?
My response is, again, I would wonder whether this comes from blind faith or from actual serious committed study of the problem. Because for me, if you just would take a cursory glance at Black history in the colony, in the American colony specifically, you would see that voting has not seemed to be a solution. In fact, the actual institution itself has been deliberately discriminatory to Black people every step of the way, including the present moment. You find now that there are efforts by this administration to remove the political power of cities that are considered Black cities, like Philadelphia and Atlanta. There are polling places shut down in Black communities. There is the continuous threat that is a mirror of the Klan's threat in the 1910s, 1920s, with the modernized Klan, which is Trump rally supporters going into places to intimidate people with guns. This, if we, in some ways we speak about voting with the presumption that voting is equal to one person, one vote, when voting has been proven in this colony to be not one person, one vote. It has been proven to be that a significant portion of Black people are in some ways dispossessed of that political power, disenfranchised. And so that is the history. To say again, despite that history, that one's faith should be in turning out the vote. Well, if the vote is intimidated, attacked, suppressed, in other ways, destroyed, then that means that one continuously is committed to the invisibility of Black struggle, as only interested in the blind faith of patriotism and the state. And I think that that in itself might be considered racist.
So just to follow up on that a bit, you don't feel that a state like Georgia, which has all those dynamics you talked about, voter suppression. I mean, Georgia is Dixie, right? And the fact that Black women, mainly Black women, leading this this effort to have enfranchisement of the Black vote, and the fact that it did go blue, that's not some sort of major change. That's just one of those progressive things that happens in the midst of colonialism.
One, the electoral, the conclusion of who ended up voted is not the conclusion of who exactly is in the state. Like these are not the exact same numbers. And so next time it could be something different. And so the question that did Georgia go blue always needs to be factoring that Georgia is, we're speaking about the electorate, we're not necessarily speaking about the people of Georgia. So anything can move. People say that Trump actually galvanized the racist vote or the far-right vote, whatever you want to call it. And so maybe next time they can do that again. That's entirely possible. So my argument is that I wouldn't have faith in the electoral system to be a useful avenue towards Black freedom. Because remember, even now, there are still efforts by the administration to overturn Georgia's election, or to there's continuously efforts to overturn elections in a number of different places. And so my worry is that to say that, yes, say Alabama and Mississippi turned blue in 2024, that's still not enough to suggest that, freedom now has arrived. Because we seem to be shuffling from survival in a colonial state, which is still full of mass incarceration, discrimination, and police violence all the time, to the possible fulfillment of the Nazi vision. And so these spaces between survival and catastrophe, these spaces between mass incarceration and possibility of increased migrant detentions and deportations and wholesale overt racist disenfranchisement. That is not sustainable, and that is not satisfactory to anyone that is actually considering Black freedom to be important. So no matter what happens in the electoral system, the colony in itself has proven that it is not amenable to Black freedom. And there has not been given any evidence to kind of, to show why we should believe that. The only evidence is faith in the state. And that faith in the state is in itself a faith that the institutions that dispossessed indigenous people and kept people in slavery and continues to be the main institution of anti-Black violence has some kernel of peace and hope in it. Hope in anti-Black institutions aren't best road ahead for Black freedom, I would say.
That's a good place to move into maybe some of the historical or dynamics that you've talked about that account for white supremacy and fascism in the United States. Just a reminder to our listeners that we're speaking with Yannick Giovanni Marshall, who's an academic and scholar of African studies, has written quite extensively on a variety of topics related to Black studies about racism in the United States. The waves you hear in the background are from the Indian Ocean, where Giovanni is speaking from. I'm speaking in Montreal. Giovanni, Yannick, with previous guests, when we talk about some of these topics, you know, we've looked back into history, you know, back to the Civil War, say, the history of slavery, in terms of electoral politics, you know, the insurgency Pat Buchanan campaign in 92 or George Wallace in 68, the fact that there's always been candidates whose appeals to anti-Blackness has gotten a wide appeal beyond the stereotype of white racists in the South. You know, such as with working class white voters in cities like Philly, Detroit, Milwaukee, etc. You have your take, of course, your analysis of our historical understanding of this. One way you've expressed it in the aftermath of the George Floyd uprising is that there's always going to be confusion in recognizing fascism or Nazism in the United States. They've always been, those fascists have always been there, they've never disappeared, they're just part of the DNA, they're normalized. So can you talk about that a bit, the fact that there's this confusion about recognizing normalized fascism in the U.S. and seeing someone like Trump as an exception rather than part of a pattern that goes back to the founding of the United States?
Yeah, if you just look at the mainstream media's speaking on Trump, it took probably years for them to actually say things like, well, maybe this president is racist. And they only say that not very often at all. They would say things like Trump is really revealing himself to be doing things that are past the norm, or that these things are racially charged, or a number of other things. There's always a move to take a detour from what is plain and obvious. The fact that Trump actually started his campaign, one, everybody knows, with the Mexican rapist plan, but also putting Andrew Jackson in the Oval Office, or allowing Andrew Jackson to be put in the Oval Office. And Andrew Jackson is someone that was an advocate for indigenous genocide and slavery. To find his administrators continuously being caught up in white nationalist institutions, etc. All of these things seem to be not enough. Even though anyone, a dispassionate and objective observer would say, well, you know what, there might be a racist problem here. It took a number of years, and still, for the vast majority of people, still believe that the 72 million people that voted for this person might be really interested in fiscal policy rather than have a history-long obsession with anti-Blackness and racism in general. And this delay in itself is a delay that allows people to continuously believe in the America is America the good. The colony is always improving, change will come, things are getting better, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All ideas based not in a cursory glance at American history, but based in the propaganda that is the American state. Nazism can be shouted down in other places because, and that works specifically with American nationalism, that America is good and elsewhere is bad. So where Nazism is considered bad, we can see people deriding it in Hungary or in Poland or in the new movements in Germany. But all of these things are separate and apart from American culture. Despite the fact that Nazism basically wrote and thought about the American work in elimination, etc. So patriotism, nationalism, and the idea of America always being fundamentally good, coupled with the disregard of Black life, the actual invisibility of Black life, the not being able to think about Black history and tallying it up and factoring it in one's estimation of the state. Those things together make it normal and natural for one to step over the bodies of the colony and say that none of these actually amount to a red mark on the state, that the state is always, regardless, perfectly redeemable. Because the destruction of bodies and lives and futures that happened on a day-to-day basis every day in the state do not matter. So racism allows one to believe in Americans' innocence and believe that Nazism doesn't exist here. Even for people that would say that they align with general principles of Nazism, just rather not have Nazism itself or say Nazism itself, largely because they would think of it as a German import.
That wraps up the December 2020 Pandemic Red Zone edition of No One's Legal Radio, which is part of No Borders Media and the CKUT Communities Collective's Off the Hour at 90.3 FM in Montreal, www.ckut.ca on the web. On today's show, we got perspective and analysis on U.S. politics in the context of the end of the Trump administration, but not the end of Trumpism, and the beginning of the neoliberal Biden administration. We just heard from Africanist and Black Studies scholar Yannick Giovanni Marshall, author of the post-election article, After This Election, We Should Not Come Together. We also heard from an editor of It's Going Down, an essential news source on resistance to oppression in the United States, as well as from Shane Burley, author of Fascism Today, What It Is and How to End It. All three interviews were short excerpts of longer interviews that will be featured online on No Borders Media. Thanks to Spencer, Gao, other members of CKUT, and Kialina for their support on today's show. No One's Legal Radio highlights the struggles of communities and resistance with a focus on the self-determination struggles of Indigenous peoples, migrants, refugees, and working-class people of color. No One's Legal Radio is in public confrontation with the Canadian state, organizing to fight against poverty, racism, police brutality, prisons, detentions, and deportations, as well as opposing the displacement and genocide of Indigenous peoples on Turtle Island.
Are you a tenant in Montreal? Do you have questions about your rights? Your local housing committee can help. To find the housing committee for your neighborhood or for more resources, go to www.rclalq.qc.ca. Good evening. It's 6 o'clock. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, the show about theater on the radio, from drama to musicals to burlesque to comedy and everything in between. Professional, student, and community productions in and around Montreal, Chautauqua, where we spell theater with an R-E at the end. I'm your host, Sarah DeAy, recording from home on Thursday, April 28th, 2022. An absolutely jam-packed show on the way. Writer Marc-André Thibault and director Ellen David team up to take his play, Mazel Tov, to new audiences.
Ellen, she came and saw the show and we said, okay, we should try to do an English version. So I'm really thrilled about it.
So I went to see the play and I was just sort of blown away. I mean, it was very dark, very funny, very tragic comic, and it just sort of pushed the envelope in so many ways.
Lisa Rubin at the Siegel Center also has a newly translated play, April Fools, a rock cabaret about a woman who dares to indulge in a fantasy.
But she questions, you know, can we find room or make room, or why do we not allow ourselves to talk about the fantasies that are buried, the secrets that are buried within us? And I think that's a very rare thing that we to present on stage. We don't talk about that a lot.
Jimmy Blay at Geordie Theatre on From the Stars in the Sky to the Fish in the Seas, teaching kids to accept themselves.
The way that we're trying to have people look at it through this story is that things are just a little bit more complex than the binary or polarity or duality. There's a lot of things that live in between those two poles, let's say.